you'll find descriptions of real events and actual confessions of demonic encounters in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Afraid, Demon Possession and Spiritual Warfare in America. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Robert Bennett. Afraid is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Afraid, Demon Possession and Spiritual Warfare in America. Okay, now you're in the thick of the debate. You are pro-life, the other person is pro-choice, and they are throwing fast and furious at you every objection in the book. Now, you could stop and try and take them one at a time. That's a good piece of advice. But how do you do that? How do you engage the objection itself without simply dismissing it? And without doing what so often happens in debates like these, where they make their point, you make your point, and the two never really meet. Nor do you any deeper understand the other person's point of view, as wrong as that point of view may be, when you're trying to defend the unborn. Scott Klusendorf joins us for part three of our four-part weekly series on equipping pro-life Christians for that very debate. Today we're going to be answering objections persuasively. How do you do it? Maybe not so much by giving answers, but asking questions. Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute and author of the new book, The Case for Life. You can join us, 1-877-623-6943, 1-877-623-MYIE. Or you can email your questions or comments for Scott to talkback@issuesetc.org. We get those questions or comments right here in the studio. Scott, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Why is it so important that we begin in this debate with questions rather than statements?
I think there's a couple of reasons. The first is it helps you get an accurate assessment of the other person's view. What often happens in debates one-on-one or in small groups is that people tend to distort their critics' views. Now, sometimes this is not intentional, but it's nonetheless done. Or maybe what happens is they've heard a similar line of argument and they assume that that's what the person's saying. By asking questions, you can accomplish a couple of things. Number one, you can clarify exactly what the person actually believes so that you can accurately represent it and not distort it. Secondly, you can determine what their reasons are for believing what they believe so that you can respond appropriately to those reasons. And then thirdly, it gives you a way to help them think more clearly about their own position and the price they might have to pay by holding it.
Okay, so what kind of questions are we talking about in general here?
I like what my colleague Greg Kokel has come up with. He calls these the Columbo questions, named after the infamous detective on TV that listeners over age 35, maybe 40, will remember quite well. But Columbo is this kind of disheveled, inept, at least he seems that way, inept, kind of babbling detective that the crooks think will never figure out what happened. And Kokel rightly points out that Columbo's strength is he just keeps asking questions until he finally nails the crook. And I think there's three Columbo questions that are important to use, and I outline them in the book, The Case for Life. The first question you want to use is simply this: what do you mean by that? And this is a clarification inquiry that tells you what your opponent thinks so that you can accurately represent his view, and at the same time, it forces him to think more clearly about his own statements. For example, I've been this last week, leading up to Easter, been in a dialogue with a classmate of mine from high school who has become an atheist, and his big argument all week leading up to Easter. In fact, if you view my Facebook page, you can follow this thread. His big argument was that the Bible's been changed a bunch of times, that the resurrection was made up by the apostles later, that the whole thing was one big myth. So, of course, when he said the Bible's been changed many times, my first question is, well, how so? In what way? Now, notice this makes him think clearly about what he's saying. He can't just get away with making an assertion. Now I'm beginning the process of finding out the reasons why he thinks what he thinks. And then after he listed a few reasons, he said at one point, oh, well, you know, the Christian gospel is borrowed from earlier pagan and Greek myths. And I said, oh, really? Why do you think that? Now I'm asking him for reasons. And it turned out, of course, that I was able to show him that the Christian gospel and its proclamation of bodily resurrection was nothing like the Greek myth that said bodily resurrection was not even possible. But the way I set up that discussion was to ask the right questions. Tell me what you believe, tell me why you believe it, and then the third question, of course, the one that really helps people see that they're going to pay too high a price for their view, is to simply say, have you considered the implications of your view? These questions can really make a difference.
Okay, so it sounds as though what you may discover early on in this process, and it really does take some concentration and self-control to do this, because red herrings and detours and being led around by the nose is just as easy for the pro-lifer as for anybody else. But it sounds like you might discover that your pro-choice opponent may not have thoroughly considered the statements that he's making.
Exactly right. Here's a classic example. Someone comes up to the pro-lifer and says, well, you know, embryos are just a mass of cells, so why should they have a right to life? My first question is going to be, Todd, well, what do you mean embryos are just a mass of cells? What does that mean? Now, I can tell you right now, the person has no concept of the difference between a mass of cells, like skin cells on the back of my hand, and a living organism like the embryo is, that is not a mass of cells, but is a distinct whole living entity. They have no concept of that important distinction. So I'll simply say, what do you mean the embryo's just a mass of cells? They'll bumble away with some answer, and then I'll follow up with, tell me why you think you're right about the embryo being just a mass of cells. Now, notice what this does. This puts the burden of proof back on the person making the claim. Too often, Christians assume the burden of proof when it's not theirs to assume. And pro-life Christians fall into this all the time. The critic of the pro-life view starts firing off assertions, and we think we owe a rebuttal to every one of these assertions. Wait a minute. The critic is the one making the claim. Let him defend his own claims. And that's why these Columbo questions are so effective.
Someone says, look, you just can't legislate morality. And what you're trying to do here is outlaw all abortions. And the law simply is the wrong tool to do that. How would you respond to that?
Well, the first thing I would say is, tell me what you mean by legislating morality. Because here's the problem, Todd. If laws aren't the legislating of morality, meaning if there's no moral principle behind the law, then what we're doing is taking away people's freedom with no moral foundation for doing so, meaning that lawmakers will simply be legislating their personal preferences, and that's the only justification they'll be left with for saying a human being doesn't have the freedom to do a particular act. Well, obviously, that's not a good justification for taking away someone's freedom. There has to be a moral foundation for the law, or we resort to mere preferences and mere power as exercised by lawmakers. So my first question will be, what do you mean by legislating morality? And then, of course, I'm going to ask them why they think morals have no business being in law. That is going to stymie them. Because if they stop to think about it, they'll see that there are moral principles undergirding every law that's out there. Can anybody, even a secular liberal, listen to Barack Obama and not think that he's advocating moral positions? Now, we may not agree that his positions are morally correct, but he is using moral language to buttress his own opinions. He's not saying, oh, this is just my personal view. He is giving reasons that he wants us to accept as being morally correct as the foundation for the legislative agendas he wants to enact.
Here's a big objection, and I'd like your response to it. And I think it's probably been around as long as abortion has been legal. And that is, if we step back one inch from Roe v. Wade and the freedoms granted thereby, then women will die from illegal back alley coat hanger abortions all over again.
Yeah, I love this one. The assumption is that women will be forced to go get illegal abortions. But I'm not going to buy that assumption, because laws that protect the unborn don't force women to do anything. I mean, this is like someone kind of saying, look, because the state won't put me on welfare, I'm going to be forced to rob a bank. No, we have other choices here, and women certainly do as well. But notice that this objection, this so-called coat hanger objection, assumes the unborn are not human beings. Why should the law be faulted, Todd, for making it more risky for one human being to take the life of another completely innocent one? Should we legalize bank robbery, for example, so that it can be safer for felons? The only way we can argue this way is if we begin with the assumption that the unborn are not already human beings, but that, of course, as we've discussed many times before, is precisely the point under dispute. We've got to answer the question, what is the unborn, before we can say it's okay to kill the unborn because some people might be harmed trying to kill them. One other thing, there's simply no factual evidence to back up the claim that women are going to die in droves from back alley abortions. I present in the book detailed statistical studies that indicate this didn't happen before Roe versus Wade, and there are good models out there showing it's unlikely to happen again.
Scott Klusendorf is our guest, part three of a four-part weekly series we're doing with him here on Issues Etc., equipping pro-life Christians for the debate. Today, answering objections persuasively, we're dealing with some of those common objections. You've heard them all. I want to hear from you as well. If you've got an objection you think needs an answer, 1-877-623-6943, coming to you live this Monday, the 13th of April, 1-877-623-6943, or email your questions or comments to us right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org. When we come back, pro-lifers are too narrow. They need to broaden their focus to other issues.
I know your brothers and your sister and your mother too. Man, I wish you could see them too.
Oh. He was taken away. There's a place for the baby that died, and there's a time for the mother who cried.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkins. Scott Klusendorf is our guest, president of Life Training Institute, author of the new book, The Case for Life. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Here's Millie in St. Louis. Hi, Millie. Thanks for waiting.
That's fine. Well, this is a comment. Not too nice of a comment to tell you, Todd. My grandson broke the news to us yesterday as they were leaving from Easter celebration that he resigned from his job because he does research in that in a lab, that they were using some stem cell embryonics, and he could not do this. He could not do this. So he is without a job, and his Christian ethics would not allow him to carry on.
Millie, you have every reason to be very proud of your grandson, and yes. Certainly keep him in our prayers, too. Thank you very much, Millie. Scott, your reaction.
Well, yes, sad news that he has lost his job, but let's give this guy a good attaboy. I mean, that's the kind of courageous actions doctors are more and more going to be faced with, lab workers are going to be faced with, pharmacists. The reality is, Todd, that there is no doubt that the current administration and the Democratic majority in Congress would love to force all pro-life medical professionals out of the field, and they're going to do their best to accomplish that. And it's going to get real interesting here in the future when you get directives coming down from either the executive branch or the legislative branch or both telling doctors that if they are not complicit in the abortion decision, meaning either perform abortions or refer for them, they will not be allowed to practice medicine. It's going to be interesting to see how the Catholic hospitals respond. That's 15% of the U.S. healthcare, and the bishops have made noises, and I hope they'll stick to it, that if the government does this, they will simply instruct their medical facilities to defy the order, or they'll shut them down. And it's going to take that kind of hardball approach to tell the federal government to get back and stop defying the rights of pro-life medical professionals.
This objection is one that, oddly, we heard in the last election cycle from more and more pro-life people who would say, look, I'm against abortion, I'm pro-life, but we're too narrow. Abortion should be one subject, one issue among many for us, and it really doesn't deserve this kind of exclusive priority that we've given it.
Yeah. Well, you know, whenever I hear that, I think to myself that, gee, well, why don't we blame Winston Churchill and FDR for focusing too narrowly on defeating the Nazis to the neglect of other issues? You know, given a choice, Todd, I'd rather pro-lifers focus on at least one great moral issue than waste their precious resources trying to fix all of them. Imagine someone going to the American Cancer Society and saying, you have no right to focus so narrowly on cancer when you're not doing much to fight these other issues. Why aren't you solving things like heart attacks? Why aren't you working to fix diabetes? Why aren't you working to solve childhood deaths from auto accidents? You're being too narrow. I mean, we would think such a claim ridiculous, and rightfully so. Well, how does it follow that because the pro-lifer opposes the deliberate destruction of an innocent human being, he must therefore take responsibility for all of societal ills? It's simply ridiculous to make that kind of claim, and pro-lifers need to focus like a laser beam on the real issue here, which is the destruction of innocent human life.
Shouldn't there be at least one exception, one hard and fast moral exception for the pro-lifer, and that is rape?
Rape is an interesting question, and it comes up in virtually every debate or presentation I make where I'm able to entertain questions. And two types of people will raise this question, Todd. The first is the learner who really wants an answer, and then there's the crusader who's simply trying to make the pro-lifer look bad. And it's important to know who is asking the question. And it will become apparent just from the tone of the question. The question is usually posed as follows. Look, this woman who's been raped, every time she looks at this child, she's going to remember what she went through. Isn't it cruel for us to not allow her to have an abortion? The one thing we must not do, Todd, is to minimize the pain of the woman involved here. Yes, she is going to suffer. Yes, it's true that when she looks at this child, she will have memories. We should never do what some pro-lifers have done, and that is to simply say, well, if she just has the child, everything will work out. Look, that's nonsense, and it's simply not true. What we need to do is ask a very specific question that gets us back to the real issue, what is the unborn? And here's that question. When the person brings up the rape objection, I ask them very, very nicely, but very directly, how do you think an innocent human being should be treated by society when that innocent human being reminds us of something painful? In other words, how should a civil society treat innocent human beings that remind us of a painful event? Is it okay to kill them so we can feel better? And I let the question sink in. Well, the person at that point will have to say, well, no, you can't kill innocent human beings for that reason. And they're right. Human beings shouldn't be killed simply because they remind us of something painful. Hardship doesn't justify homicide. Usually what will happen at that point is the person will realize they've got to answer a prior question, and that prior question is, what is the unborn? They may try to dodge that question, but that's the issue they've got to answer. And then I very gently press the point that sometimes the right thing to do is not the easy thing to do. I can sympathize with that woman. But to give you an example, suppose I am an American commander over in Iraq and my unit gets captured by terrorists. And the leader of the terrorists comes to me and says, look, we're going to start torturing you and your men in about 5 minutes. But if you'll help us torture your own men to get information out of them, we won't torture you. Now, can I, as those men's leader, take that deal? Not a chance. I've got to choose to suffer evil rather than inflict it. Sometimes the right thing to do isn't the easy thing to do. And then I explain to my listener that although I don't like how that answer feels, because, again, it's easy for me to sympathize with a woman that I can see while it's difficult to sympathize with her child that I can't, I believe it's the right answer because sometimes, as I said a moment ago, what's right is not easy. Now, that answer will generally more or less satisfy the listener. It will not satisfy the crusader who simply is out to make you look bad. So what I do with that person is I say, okay, let's assume for the sake of debate that I agree with you that we should allow abortion in cases of rape. I don't hold that view, but let's grant it for the sake of discussion. Will you then join me in working to protect all other unborn children that are not conceived through rape? Right away, the person's going to say no, at which point I'm able to say, aha, then your real position is not that abortion should only be legal in cases of rape. Your real view is it's a fundamental right a woman should be allowed to exercise for any reason she wants through all 9 months of pregnancy. Why don't you defend that view instead of hiding behind the hard case of rape? That way I blow their smoke screen out of the water.
Folks, when you purchase Scott's new book called The Case for Life by using the Amazon.com link from the on-demand page of our website, the percentage of your purchase will help support Issues, etc. Our website, issuesetc.org. Click On Demand and look for the book, The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf. Scott, next Monday we're going to conclude our four-part series with you discussing teaching and equipping pro-life Christians. What's on tap for next week? About 30 seconds here.
We'll talk about the role of pastors in this debate. What are four essential tasks that pastors who call themselves pro-life need to accomplish in their local churches? We'll also talk a little bit about how evangelical Christians can work with non-evangelicals on this issue without sacrificing their core doctrinal distinctives. The third thing we'll look at, and we'll do this as time permits, is what can pro-lifers do to prepare for the future so that we begin to rebuild our movement for long-time success?
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute, author of the new book, The Case for Life. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Todd.
The objections are many. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But first of all, if we engage those who bring their objections to the defense of the unborn with a few simple questions. What do you mean by that? Where did you get that idea? Have you ever considered the alternative? And then give honest responses to their objections, thinking always about the center of the debate. Who is the unborn? We will do well. When we come back, there are a number of objections, alternate theories to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We're going to spend the second hour of this Monday, the 13th of April, with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery answering objections to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Some people say he didn't really die. He just swooned, unconscious for a day or two, then stumbled out of the tomb, apparently risen from the dead. And since no one seemed to be the wiser, he just let the story persist. Or maybe his disciples simply made the story up and stole his body or left his body there and no one checked. Or maybe when they checked the wrong tomb. Maybe they hallucinated. Or they conspired together to concoct the story much later to save face. Do any of these alternate theories for the resurrection of Jesus Christ hold any real water, even in terms of their evidence? We'll answer that question in the second hour of Issues, etc. You can join us as well, 1-877-623-6943, or talk back at issuesetc.org. When we come back, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery answering objections against the bodily resurrection of Jesus.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, etc. Issues, etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.